This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
It's a simple question, really. Are there planets around other stars? Yet, when Geoffrey Marcy posed the question over 20 years ago, most of the scientific community thought it was impossible to answer. Finding other worlds like our own challenged the best technology at the time. Because stars are so bright and planets so comparably dim, even the largest telescopes could not directly distinguish a planet in the glare of its sun. Marcy developed a technique to indirectly detect planets instead. As a planet orbits, it tugs gravitationally on its star, causing a tiny wobble. The wobble shifts the star's light, and the size of that shift can tell a planet hunter how large the planet is and how closely it circles its sun. By measuring changes in starlight over time and refining his technique for over a decade, Marcy became one of the first humans to spot planets beyond our solar system and prove their existence. He has since discovered more extrasolar planets than anyone. Marcy now leads the search for Earth-like planets and life elsewhere in the universe. He is a professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2002.
My name is Geoff Marcy, and I'm an astronomer currently at UC Berkeley, and I search for planets around other stars. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley in the suburbs of Los Angeles. Lots of houses, very suburban, some strip malls. My recollection of my childhood from the age of about, 10 to 17 was mostly playing outside in the streets. I used to like sports. I played a lot of music, played piano and cello, and I used to like to play basketball and football and baseball. And every once in a while I thought I might be a baseball player later in life. And I attended public schools, just the regular Los Angeles public school district, and I was sort of an average, I would say above average student, but not an certainly not an excellent student. I studied, did my homework sort of half reluctantly, and so that's the way I view my childhood.
What did your parents do?
My mom started as a sort of 1950s, 60s housewife. She had gotten a bachelor's degree in anthropology. And then after I went to junior high school around 9th or 10th grade, she decided to go back and get her ed degree, and she became a teacher. So in my last few years or so in the household, she was an elementary school teacher.
What inspired her to change what she was doing?
What inspired her was, to the best of my ability to understand, is that in the mid to late 60s, which was that era, I was 13 years old or so, the women's movement was becoming more important, and civil rights issues were becoming quite prominent, of course, in the United States. And my mom, I think, started thinking to herself that she wanted to take some pride in some work that she did. And I think she loved teaching, she loved students, and she likes thinking carefully. And so I think that her sense of herself as a professional person started becoming more prominent. And I remember it bothered my dad a little bit that she was going to go off and become a part of the breadwinning team. But I think that it was part of a normal evolution for her personally, and sort of a part of the national scene of how women were changing their views of themselves.
Did she take part in either of those movements at all?
Yeah, she was fairly active in the civil rights movement. I can remember in 1964, there was something called the Fair Housing Act that was being considered. And she went door to door in our neighborhood trying to let people know that it was best to pass the Fair Housing Act. And that was an act, if I recall correctly, that made it illegal to deny the sale of a home or the purchase of a home to people of color.
How did you first become interested in science?
I don't exactly know the answer to that, really. I think the best way I can answer it is to say that both of my parents were curious. My dad, I didn't actually say, my dad was an aerospace engineer. So he, you know, as an engineer, he was interested in sort of the tinker toys of nature, how things work. And my mom, being more on the anthropology side, was more interested in people and psychology and culture. So both of them, I'm sure, discussed things with me about how things work and how people work. But I remember the lightning rod for me was when I was about 13 years old, my parents bought me a poster for my bedroom of the solar system. And it had the sun on the left, and I can remember the planets strewn out on the right. And I remember as a kid staring up at that poster. I can still remember sort of counting the moons of Jupiter and amazed at the rings of Saturn and imagining what those places were like. So the poster was was the spark. The next year, my parents bought me a used telescope. So I was 14 years old, and it was a crummy little telescope, 4-inch diameter mirror, and my dad said something about a friend of his didn't want it anymore, and so that kind of thing. But I just loved that little telescope, and I still have it today. And I used to take it out of my window of my bedroom. I used to actually crawl out onto a patio roof and put the telescope out there. And being Southern California, it didn't rain during the whole summer, so I would just leave it out there. And every night I'd go out and look at Saturn, look at the moon Titan orbiting Saturn. I would watch the moons of Jupiter. I was really intrigued by the beauty and the grandeur and just the sheer distances, the scale of the universe. But even, you know, our own solar system just seemed very profound and unbelievably gorgeous to me. So that made a big impact, seeing with my own eye the beauty of the universe.
Did you think right away, I want to be an astronomer?
I don't think I knew anybody could be an astronomer exactly. I didn't quite know that you could be an astronomer. I knew that my dad wanted me to be good in science, and I think my mom was a little more open-minded. She would have been happy if I was good at anything, but I think there was a kind of a nudge that I kept feeling from my dad to do well in math and chemistry and physics and so on. So I think when I look back on it, somehow I had the unconscious impression that science was important. And I don't know why I thought that. And in retrospect, I think it seems kind of naive and influenced from the outside, maybe more so than from the inside. I can't tell how much came from within and how much came from my parents. But somehow by the age of 15, 16, 17, science seemed serious and important, and other things seemed less so. So it was natural for me then to go to college and study physics, which is what I did.
So then what was your experience like as an undergrad?
I went to UCLA, and I was a physics major, and then I switched to astronomy major, and then I realized, oh, I'm never going to make it, so I better just be a physics major so I can get a job someday. And then I thought, well, but I really love astronomy, so I got to follow my heart, so I'll switch to astronomy major. And finally, I was a double major. But the thing that's very clear to me, and I can still remember it now, you know, 30-some-odd years later, was what a huge struggle it was for me. I studied really hard. I kind of was a B-plus student. I felt like I was just hanging on by my fingertips. I took, you know, electricity and magnetism, and at least a third, if not half of the students, were just smarter than I was. And all of my other physics classes were that way. I always felt, as hard as I worked, there were 20-30% of the kids in my class who just got it faster. It was more like, you know, the proverbial fish swimming for them, whereas you know, I felt like I was weighed down by lead weights, you know. And so I worked really hard, partly because I wanted to learn this stuff, partly because I was afraid of failure. And between the two, I ended up learning a lot, getting decent grades, and being able to keep going forward.
And then what happened?
It was funny, because I was a double major. I took some astronomy classes, and those went a little better for me. Astronomy was somehow different. Is more intuitive for me, and somehow the clockwork of the universe, the way stars go around a galaxy, the way the universe expands, it all made more sense to me. So somehow I was a little better at that. And I got positive feedback from my professors. One of them, I remember, let me grade a class. I could be a grader, you know, which was a great honor. And another professor, Mike Jura, took me under his wing and let me do research with him. So that led me to apply to graduate school in astronomy.
And what was that like?
You know, honestly, it was kind of more of the same. I felt like I was struggling the whole time. And it sounds like a kind of a negative, downer way to describe it, but it's the truth. So I think the only way to describe it is with the truth. Otherwise, it's whitewashing and sugarcoating something. I mean, I loved astronomy, and I loved thinking about the universe and our place in the universe and how we humans and the Earth fit in to the grand scheme. But to actually do it in the academic setting was really hard for me.
And yet you stayed with it. Other than fear of failure, fear that you wouldn't find something else, was there something else that helped you?
Well, there was. Yeah, what really helped me was toward the end of my graduate career, fifth year graduate school. You usually take 6 years to get a PhD. In my fifth year, my research started doing really well. I was measuring magnetic fields on other stars with something called the Zeeman effect. And nobody else was doing this, and I was trying it with some new spectrometers, a new technique. You know, every day was just a tiny itty-bitty bit of progress. But it started to work, and suddenly I felt a lot of pride. I could learn something about other stars, namely their magnetic fields, that nobody else knew. And it was very, you know, gratifying to realize that I could contribute something, finally, after all that time. So that made me feel really good. And then it was even better when I finished my PhD and I got offered a postdoctoral fellowship at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. As a postdoc, I think I reverted back. So I was working on my research, and I became, this was 1982, and I wanted to continue measuring magnetic fields on stars, but it wasn't going very well. A Harvard faculty member wrote a paper in the prestigious Astrophysical Journal saying that Marcy's measurements of magnetic fields really didn't look very good to him. They're mostly wrong, and I was off base and naive and so on. He was overly harsh, and I only learned later that particular Harvard professor is basically a nutcase. But I didn't know that. So I just felt bad. And I thought, okay, this is it. I'm back to square one again. I guess I'm not smart. And I thought, okay, I've still got 2 years as a postdoc here at the Carnegie Institution. I'm obviously not cut out to be a scientist. I'm just going to do research for the next 2 years that I want to do. And I thought, I'm going to ask a question and try to answer a question that I want to know, not what the authorities want to know. And the question I really wanted to know the answer to was whether there were planets around other stars, whether there were other Earths, whether there was life elsewhere in the universe. Are there other critters like us humans out there? And I applied for telescope time at Mount Wilson on the venerable 100-inch telescope and began for 2 years. I searched for planets and learned a lot in those two. Didn't find any, but I learned a lot about how to search for planets, where the errors were, how you could improve the technique. And that was the beginning of my searching for planets. Once I decided to hunt for planets, and that was 1983, I didn't find any until 1995. 12 years later. So I took a job as a professor at San Francisco State University, and I was lucky enough to run into a student at San Francisco State, Paul Butler, who was brilliant and worked very hard, and he worked hard with me. And so Paul and I, made enormous progress. But 12 years is a long time to not get any satisfaction, not get any detections. But then when we did, it was crazy.
How do you hunt for planets?
Looking for planets is conceptually easy and technically very difficult. The idea is simply that a star that's orbited by a planet, for example, the stars you see in the night sky, they don't reveal their planets easily. You can point at a star with the Hubble Space Telescope, and you don't see the planets. They're lost in the glare of the host star. So we devised a trick, and actually it was a well-known trick. For 100 years, the trick has been known. And that is, you can watch the star. As a planet orbits the star, the planet will yank gravitationally on the star. It's a little bit like a dog owner taking her dog for a walk in the park. She'll be holding the dog on the end of the leash, and the dog moving around will yank on the dog owner, and she'll get pulled to and fro. Even without seeing the dog, you could tell that there is a dog on the end of the leash by watching how she's jerked around and how massive the dog is by how violently she gets jerked around. Little poodles aren't going to do much, but, you know, a big Alaskan Malamute will yank on the dog owner pretty strongly. And the same is true for a star and its planet. In that case, the leash is gravity. And so we watch the star, and we can see the stars get jerked around by their planets. And we do it with the Doppler effect. We actually measure the light waves from the star and watch to see if the light waves coming from a star alternately compress and stretch and compress and stretch. And light waves would do that as the star approaches us and then recedes away from us and approaches us and recedes away from us as the star is pulled to and fro by the unseen planet. And so that's the basic idea. The concept is easy. That's the end of it. The technical part was the real challenge. It turns out, as you can imagine, this Doppler shift is a tiny, tiny effect. And so the light waves actually change their wavelengths. They stretch and compress by unbelievably tiny amounts, a part in 100 million. And so we had to be able to measure wavelengths of light coming from stars hundreds of light years away and determining whether those waves of light were compressed or stretched by just one part in 100 million. So that was hard, and it took a long... That's why it took 12 years.
So you did this for 12 years.
Yeah.
And all the while refining your technique and getting more and more time to try this out
at
telescopes. What did other astronomers think about it when you showed up at a telescope and said, oh, this is what we're doing? How did the community see the work that you were doing?
That's an amazing question, because people were embarrassed for me, really. Real scientists don't hunt for ET. And essentially, by looking for planets around other stars, which everybody knew was impossible, you couldn't find planets around other stars. Everybody knew it would be interesting if you could, but you can't. So I was fishing to accomplish something that people knew was impossible, and also fishing for something that seemed science fiction-y. And so it was not proper science. Proper astronomers were studying the chemical compositions of stars and the structure of galaxies, not looking for planets like Earth. So I can remember some well-respected astronomers, when I told them what I was working on, they would look down at their shoes, scuffle their feet, and change the subject.
What happened when the technology finally came around and you could actually see this Jupiter yanking on its star?
Something explosive actually happened, and it was October of 1995. Some colleagues, friends of mine in Geneva, Switzerland, announced in Florence, Italy, on October 6th, 1995, that they had found the first planet ever around another star. 51 Pegasi was the name of the star. And it was a sheer lucky happenstance that 5 days later, I was assigned telescope time at Lick Observatory 4 consecutive nights to continue my planet hunting. 4 nights was a big allocation for me back then. And it just so happened that 51 Pegasi was up, so we could observe it. It wasn't behind the sun. And Paul and I observed that star all 4 nights, measuring the Doppler shift. And to back up, the claim being made, the wacky, wild claim by this Geneva group, was that the planet took 4 days to go around its host star. Well, everybody knew that planets couldn't possibly go around their star as quickly as just taking 4 days, 1 year being 4 days. It's absurd. You know, I mean, the Earth takes a whole year, not 4 days. Mercury takes, you know, 80-some-odd days. Venus takes 200-some-odd days. Well, no planet can go around its star in 4 days. So we thought, okay, this is wrong. You know, the Geneva group has it wrong, but we'll go up and we'll measure the Doppler shift of this star for 4. The lucky thing, we had 4 nights, And the orbital period of the planet was 4 days. So we could actually monitor the star during one full year, so to speak, of this supposed putative planet. And each night we made the Doppler shift measurement, and by the end of 4 nights, we plotted up the measured Doppler shifts. And sure enough, the star was being yanked on by a planet taking 4.2 days, just as Michel Mayor and Didier Collot at Geneva had said. And I can remember driving off the mountain with Paul, my hands clutching the steering wheel going down that mountain road, thinking, this is the first planet ever discovered around another star. And we had confirmed it right there on the spot. It caused a huge furor. And in brief, what happened was we came off the mountain. The press people at San Francisco State learned that we had confirmed it. They put out some little press release saying planet confirmed. And then the news media descended by the hundreds. And I was on every news program, the McNeil Lehrer show. I was on Nightline. I did the Letterman show. I was on every news broadcast. And the odd thing was the Swiss team was embargoed because they had sent their paper to Nature. And so they couldn't talk to the press. So the international press just descended on me. And so every day it was nonstop, reporters, for months, just months. And then within a month or so, Paul and I found two planets of our own. And so by the following January, 3 months later, we announced our two planets. And that made the news media descend even more dramatically on us. And so it actually hasn't stopped. It's my life has been sort of under a microscope since.
Why do you think that you and Paul have gotten so much attention?
It's funny. I've had this asked of me many times, and it often gets asked of me when I'm in Europe because there's a little jealousy. And there's a few reasons for it, honestly. One is America 10 to 20 years ago was more tuned into public relations in science. Europeans had more of a, I don't know how to describe it, Europeans culturally were not as tuned into promoting their science, promoting it for resources, for funding, and so on. They've caught up and, frankly, passed us, I think, in the last 10 years. But, the NASA media machine is enormous, and the newspapers in the United States have a lot of influence. So if it shows up on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post, it gets picked up in Bangkok and Beijing. Part of it is that Michel Mayor is a older, quieter guy, and I'm more of an outgoing person. I have an ability to say things on the camera that appeal to the general public. I have Carl Sagan ringing in my head and his ability to communicate the human aspect of science to the public.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that about being able to communicate the human aspect. It's because that's what motivated you. It was this very sort of human question.
No, that's right. It's true. And I really, in the end, I've come full circle because I started wondering if there was life in the universe, other critters like us. And I now view the 6.5 billion people on this planet as a really precious natural phenomenon. I think we Homo sapiens are a dramatically remarkable phenomenon that we may not quite appreciate. I now think hard, as hard as anybody can, about extraterrestrial life, literally, whether there's intelligent life, how might we detect it, what information we already have that suggests that maybe technological life in the galaxy is a rarity. And I think it may well be, if not our being the only technological civilization in the Milky Way galaxy. And so putting all of that into perspective, this is a human endeavor. Science is a human endeavor. And together, we're accomplishing something amazing.
It sounds like the search that you've been on has made you doubtful that you'll find extraterrestrial life. Why is that?
Well, you've asked a very, really exciting question, and it's the one that I talk about in my public lectures all the time. I'm fairly sure that if intelligent technological life were common in our Milky Way galaxy with its 200 billion stars, they would already be here. And we don't detect them. And in fact, there's no sign that the aliens, the Romulans and the Klingons and the Star Trek and Star Wars critters are anywhere near us. And it would be very hard for them to hide. They could try, but it would be very hard. And there's no evidence that the aliens went to Mars. There's no debris from a crashed spacecraft that went to Mars. The moon has got footprints on it, but they're ours. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, has failed to pick up radio and television transmissions from any advanced species, despite our using our world's largest radio telescopes. So where are they all? As a good scientist, you have to take note of non-detections as much as the detections. The detections in science make the, you know, front page of the newspapers. But the non-detections can pile up and never make the newspapers. And so far, we humans have not yet seen a single shred of evidence of advanced technological species elsewhere in the universe. That's beginning to suggest that intelligent critters are rare. And I think there's reason to understand this from the evolutionary biology standpoint, from the standpoint of our Earth being a relatively rare type of planet. There's got to be other intelligent species out there. There are simply too many stars in the universe as a whole for there not to be intelligent life out there. But the nearest intelligent civilization might be 1,000 light years away or 1,000,000 light years away. And that's pretty profound, really, if you think about it. We humans are struggling, living our lives out every day, and yet we're carrying on as a collective species. We're carrying out some kind of a natural progression, namely our own evolution and our survival and the fulfillment of our dreams and so on, in a way that's somehow bigger than each of us individually.
What advice would you give to a young person interested in a career in science?
Well, you have to know yourself a little bit, first of all. And if you love science, if the questions of nature intrigue you, if you see a flower and you start asking questions about why that flower has the color it does, what role does it play in evolutionary biology, what is the composition of the flower, if your brain is working in that direction and you're intrigued and you feel a kind of a passion for those questions and for the answers of the questions, yeah, then you should just keep going in science. Just keep doing it. And I think that's when I say you have to know yourself a little bit. You have to almost have a conscious sense that, yes, you're the curious type that wonders about the nature of a flower. And I think it's better to do that than to what I, on the other hand, what I often see in contrast is people who go along in science for reasons that are not intrinsic to them in some way, like I did in some sense. You know, going along, they're worried about failing, or they're, you know, they're doing it because their mom or their dad said you have to do this, or you know, whatever. I think it's really important for people to get a sense of who they are, sense as to why they love science, if that's going to be what they end up doing. That will help them choose whether to go into science or not. And once you do become a scientist, if you know who you are, then you can sense what kind of a scientist you want to be. Do you want to be a principal investigator leading a big group? Are you happy being, a team member? So there's various ways to contribute, and you have to know yourself to know how you're going to be able to contribute.
So what would you say to a young Jeff Marcy?
Well, boy, you know, you've asked a really key question that I have answered, and I really hate to tell you the answer to this, but the answer really is, I think I should have quit. Yeah, I actually think I should have quit. The difficulty for me in grad, I mean, it's an answer that you would never expect, I know, but I've thought about it a lot, and I think I should have quit. Yeah, I wouldn't have been the one to find the planets. Somebody else would have found planets. Okay, that would be fine. You know, the Swiss team would have found them too, and then there would have been other teams elsewhere. And I'm very happy where I am right now, so that's not what I'm saying. But given how difficult it was, I'd like people to sense who they are earlier and enjoy themselves along the way in college, in graduate school, and beyond. And I think it would have been quite reasonable and, in sort of, how shall I put it, introspectively sensible for me to have quit science when I was struggling so hard. It sounds crazy, I know. It almost seems like a heartbreaker. But science isn't really about people accomplishing things. Science is, you know, its own entity, and it goes on with or without each of us individually. We don't like to believe this, but the truth is most of the scientific discoveries, even the Einstein-like discoveries, would have been made within a 10 or 20 years if Einstein had been run over by, you know, a truck. And so we do have to take care of ourselves, and we have to make decisions for ourselves. And in the end, what we're about here is not just the science. We're about allowing humanity to survive, fulfill itself generation after generation, and carry on over the centuries. And to do that, we need to know who we are. We need to know who we are individually, who we are as a culture, what we're trying to do as a species. So I think that level of insight, psychological insight and cultural insight, is more important than one of us, you know, courageously braving it through graduate school and making it to the end. So I think in retrospect, it would have made perfect sense for me to have quit earlier.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.